Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
It's February 14th, 2021, and welcome to episode 230 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I'd like to know. Will I ever find my way back to us? Will I ever find my...
The RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, collecting, and the love we feel for old computers. I say that because it's Valentine's Day, of course. But that's not actually the topic. And before we get to the topic, I will introduce myself and everyone. I am Paul Hagstrom in Boston, and I am joined today by Earl Evans in Portland. How are you?
I'm doing good. Doing our normal round about the weather. It is icy here. We had snow, and then we had freezing rain, and it's all on top of each other, and it's outside, and the town's pretty much shut down. And we've got, I don't know how many hundreds of thousands without power. I'm not one of them right now, but if I suddenly disappear, you'll know what happened.
You say big power outage right now in that area?
Yep, as we speak.
Yeah. Yeah, and I've heard some fairly dramatic things about Texas and stuff. You know, places that are not equipped for winter weather are getting it. And, you know, so...
Yeah, that pileup, you don't ever see ice on a Texan road, I guess. But good Lord, that was horrible to look at.
Yeah.
I assume that's what you mean.
And the person who, speaking about the Texas pileup, is Blake Patterson in Northern Virginia. Yes. How are you?
All the way over in Northern Virginia. I'm well. It's we were wondering about power. I don't think we had a big outage, but we had an ice storm with an 18-hour ice storm starting yesterday morning, and so the sort that just glazes all the branches and the streets, and so things start to droop, and you wonder about snapping branches and power lines. And but luckily it started to melt a bit this morning, but the roads were actually extremely treacherous in the DC area, at least in the neighborhoods. Last night it was I went to test it. I kind of wanted to take a little walk, and I put one foot on the ice, and I almost completely fell on the back of my head. And I thought, okay, I'll miss the daily walk. Whatever sanity that brings me daily, I had to pass it up yesterday. But anyway, I think we're in the clear now. Mm-hmm. And been doing a good bit of retro here as well. But I'll talk about that a little later.
I guess DC doesn't actually get that much snow that often.
Yeah, I mean, it's like we get enough snow that there are vehicles, like if a big storm is coming, like there are vehicles to ready, and they'll be kind of ready to respond, but it's not frequent enough that it happens in time to avoid shutdown. And it's typically, if you go west of DC, like in Northern Virginia, like where I am a little bit, I'm only 5 miles out, but like you get out 15-20 miles, it gets much heavier. And then parts of Maryland to the northeast are get worse as well. So, DC itself is actually, I guess, the proximity to the to the various bodies of water. It's not quite as terrible.
I was thinking, I'm trying to remember when this was, 1999 or something probably, or so. There was a very large amount of snow that was dumped there right when I was in the area. I was in Baltimore, but back and forth between Baltimore and DC. And I remember DuPont Circle was just like, it was quite a sight to behold.
If the city gets hit really hard, I mean, it just shuts everything down. I mean, you've got the metros, which is nice, I guess, if you're still having to go into the office. Typically, businesses close and It's yeah, we're not. I think you're probably a little more steeled for it up there in Boston, Boston
yeah,
than we are. And of course, you get a great deal more. I'm sure.
Ice storms can be quite hazardous. I wasn't there for it, but I have heard stories of, I think, the 1996, maybe something like that, ice storm in Montreal that sort of like took out the power for like a week or something.
Yeah.
It's really, because, you know, it just makes everything heavy and break.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I was looking at the power lines themselves, and you could see the, you know, the ice forming on it, and yeah. I guess a little more slowly than the branches above. But yeah, the ice storms have a sort of viciousness to them, because they're, you're not seeing as, you know, you're not seeing inches of snow, but much more precariously are, you know, portions of centimeters of pure ice, yeah, on the roads and sidewalks. And so, yeah, ice storms aren't so fun. I kind of enjoy the snow for what it's worth, here and there usually, but then not ice.
Yeah,
ice can kind of stay away for, in my book. But yeah, we made it through. So,
next. Okay, perhaps that's enough ice talk.
All right.
What is that, in circuit emulator? Is that what that is?
Yes, indeed.
I see.
So it's, yeah, it's got a retro tie-in.
Yep. Mm-hmm. It's Valentine's Day. Happy Valentine's Day. Who knows when people will hear this? Probably they'll hear it mid June. But at any rate, when we record, it's Valentine's Day. I say that because once again we're recording an episode before the one before it got onto the feed, but any minute now we'll catch up. The topic that we're going to talk about today, and I suspect actually for a couple of times, because I think other people on the podcast will have comments and things to say about it, has to do with issues of sort of getting video out of retro machines to modern equipment. You know, we have the problem that, you know, the things that were designed in the 80s were not designed for, you know, HDMI and 1080p or 4K monitors and that kind of thing. And we also have the fact that CRTs are finite. I don't know if people are making them anymore. I don't think they are, but you know, they're not going to work forever. Blake has prepared a bunch of notes. So maybe we could start with Blake. Actually, maybe we should start with Earl, just in case the power goes out.
No, I think Blake's going to be our subject matter expert on this. So,
okay.
Well, okay. My concern, and I guess this can be my flavor, is more with machines that were pre-VGA. VGA is a 31.5 kilohertz refresh rate, you know, which provides the proper number of lines to display the standard VGA signal, which at base was like, you know, 640 by 480 way back when. And I think there's lots of variants, names for each of the iterations of higher resolution, kind of humorously. But yes, that was the base. But the machines that I've been working with, you know, the Apple IIgs, for instance, the Atari ST, the Amiga, these have RGB outputs, which is nice. You know, there's, you easily can, you know, get an 80 column display on a decent quality color monitor. It's not, you know, this is well beyond composite, and usually the company made a matching display. Although the machines I mentioned are all in the same display class, so honestly, if you built your own cable, which I've done in the past, you can interchange all those screens amongst themselves. They're basically the same internally. So unlike the VGA, which is 31.5 kilohertz or 31 kilohertz, RGB on these machines is half that. It's 15 kilohertz display. So its rate provides half as many vertical lines. These machines typically had, you know, as far as vertical resolution, 200 pixels, 240 pixels, whereas the VGA is 400 pixels, 480 pixels. So half the lines to display, but also only ability on the hardware of the CRT to display that many lines. I guess the thing that became the obvious desire was, you know, when VGA became big, and VGA has been around since, you know, the mid 80s. I think the VGA landed with the PS2 and, you know, 86 or something like that, as I recall. But so the first thought was, oh, you can get VGA monitors everywhere and dirt cheap because every PC uses it. So how do we get, you know, VGA output onto, you know, from these machines? And there's different devices. Typically, they're called scan doublers. I guess the first time I encountered something like this was on the Amiga. The Amiga 2000, all of the Amigas have the 200-line display that I mentioned, but they also have an interlaced 400-line display. And television, the TV before LCDs that we used to all watch, standard, 4:3 aspect televisions are interlaced. You're getting, which means that 60 frames a second, but each of those frames, first is an odd lines, then even, then odd, and that alternates. And so you're really getting an effective 30 frames a second of complete data, but it's a part of it's being updated 60 times a second. The Amiga had a display mode that supported that. There certainly weren't any mainstream machines that did that at the time. And so I guess this is even, talk about everybody wanting to get output on these various computers to VGA monitors. Really on the Amiga, it was a little step before that. What, they had, the regular display modes, but they wanted to be able to view these interlaced modes without the flicker, because interlacing, it's one thing to watch television from a couch on your old CRT back in the, early 90s or late 90s. You don't notice the flicker. You're not reading it. You're not sitting in front of it as a monitor. But when you're using an Amiga or a system that would use an interlaced display, it's very noticeable. And for reading fine text, 80 column text, it's definitely noticeable. So avoid the interlace, you needed to provide interface with a monitor that had twice the scan rate. So basically a VGA monitor. Back then they were multi-scan monitors, I guess, which that sort of sidesteps it, but I'm not going to get into how multi-scan monitors maybe make it so you don't have to worry about these devices. But so in order to do that, a device came out called the Flicker Fixer. I think Microwave came out with it that fit in the Amiga 2000's little video slot. And what it did was it would take, it had access to the video signal that was being generated. It had onboard fast memory, and it would take the first frame, the 640 by 400, it would take the first frame and store it in memory. And then when the second frame came, it would merge them together and display it on a 31 kilohertz screen. It's buffering half of the draw, merging it and sending it out to a higher spec display. You needed a VGA type display, and there was no flicker. But and that's great. It's rock solid. It's basically the same idea when people on like the Atari, the GS, Acorn, Archimedes, some of the systems that they wanted to use the VGA monitor, but they didn't. It wasn't going after this interlace mode because those systems, as far as I'm aware, didn't provide that. But it's the same point.
So is the Amiga thing that you're talking about, like the Flicker Fixer, is that a modern-ish thing? I mean, is that like was that contemporary with when Amigas were still on sale, or is that sort of a modern thing?
The Flicker Fixer came out, yes, it was contemporary when they were on sale. It only actually worked in the video slot on the Amiga 2000. It was a very clean setup. Amiga had a little slot, small size slot that provided all access internally to the RGB signal. So it was easy to do this. And it was all, there was no, cabling from one place to another. It was nice and clean. I think it was probably about $250, $300, maybe even $299 device. But it was quite popular, I think. But of course, it only worked with the Amiga 2000 because it was the only one that had that slot. Mm-hmm. As time went on, interestingly, the Amiga 3000, which followed, the Amiga 2000, and I guess the 3000 landed in, maybe the very early 90s, 1990 or so. It actually, the same technology, not literally, but the same idea, they had a built-in flicker fixer. There was an additional custom chip on the Amiga 3000 motherboard. I think it was called Buster, and memory. And so it would actually, it had a VGA style output as well as the more traditional Amiga 15 kilohertz output. So you could hook it straight to a VGA monitor and you never saw flicker. And then later Amigas actually took a different approach. They had a more advanced chipset, and some of the graphics modes would actually render at a higher resolution. So they did it differently. But as a couple of years after the Flicker Fixer, some devices started coming out that are sort of generic, similar devices, but they'd be external. And so you can, there'd be one that had a cable that was appropriate for an Atari ST or a GS, and then it would output, to a standard VGA type display. Those were more general. You could use them on anything, depending on if you had the right cable. So those devices still exist. I mean, they've been around for quite a few years, and I know that some variants, more recent models, you know, from different groups are made. I think I saw another Amiga solution for old Amigas that uses a Raspberry Pi Zero has been recently created. I actually don't recall the name or the link, but basically it's using a Pi to do the, this occurs to me just as I'm talking. I kind of wish I had pulled up the link, but it's the Pi does the logic. You know, it uses its memory, and then there's an little output device that you attach to the GPIO pins that, you know, interfaces, I guess, to the output video connector.
Yeah, I guess so it sounds like a lot of these are very Amiga specific, though, right? I mean, like that's one of the things that might be kind of better about some of those cable type options is that, like, you can get one, you don't have to get like one for each of your retro computers.
Yeah, I agree with that. I guess I've been behind that platform where I had a desire to not see the flicker in these modes. I personally, like on my 2GS and Atari ST, not having those interlaced modes and, you know, kind of liking using a CRT as long as I can, I haven't really gone down the road. But yes, as a more general option, the external devices are you could certainly spread them across various machines. It seemed like most of the devices would have some sort of a, you know, connector that, you know, you could buy various cables and plug it. For whatever reason, a lot of the external ones I've seen have been, you know, specifically wired like for one system or wired for another, which kind of reduces your flexibility there. I certainly don't have a handle on all of the, you know, everything that's made now. Or I mean, you can still pick up semi-contemporary devices on eBay, you know, from, you know, maybe like the mid-90s that work on multiple platforms. And again, as I said, you can, you know, kind of assemble a Raspberry Pi sort of thing today. For those watching the live stream, I'm going to share some images that I put together and kind of talk through a few examples of what I've got here at the house.
Well, or if people are watching the YouTube later, they can see it too.
Right.
True. Yep. That's true.
Maybe we can even tweet these.
So the first scan doubler, and they're called scan doublers / flicker fixers, because when you're in an interlace mode, like this, something around the lines of 400 lines of vertical resolution, it flickers if you have an interlace mode. If you use one of these devices, when it goes to its output VGA screen, it's not flickering. Scan doubling, say you're running on a, again, on Amiga or an Atari ST or whatever the system, you have a 200 line display. Well, the VGA monitor is drawing twice as many lines. It's about 400. So what it does is, when interlace isn't an issue, it still needs to cache and double the drawing of those lines. So you're looking at a 320 by 200, say, image that's being output, but it's actually being drawn with twice as many lines. It's effectively a 320 by 400. The advantage there visually is that you don't see any scan lines, basically, because they're so small. But the negative on that is, I guess, it also looks a little more blocky and sharp, which can, you know, be a detriment compared to the original CRT. So that's what the flicker fixer / scan doubler. It's the same idea, the same device.
But it would probably look sharp. It would look sharp anyway, right? I mean, even if it weren't doubled, it would look sharp because it's on a
higher dot pitch.
Yeah.
Yes, it would look sharp. It's just like the 320 by 240, you know, PC, like Doom on a PC. Those pixels are drawn twice because the VGA screen has no native lower than 640 by 480, you know, scanning scenario. So that's why it's a higher quality and higher dot pitch display, but the monitor is actually drawing, you know, it's doing two passes for each pixel on the vertical, and so it lends the sharpness. Yeah, it's higher rate and higher dot pitch. I recall not being a fan of the sharpness of the square. You could see the little corners of the pixels. I liked the fuzzier nature of the older 15 kilohertz CRTs, but you know, there are other advantages. That was just my my take, my flavor preference. But so the first scan doubler I ever dealt with, there's a popular device from a company in Germany called Indivision, and it actually has a little bit of, I think, an FPGA, some memory, and it has a socket. You pull out one of the custom chips on the Amiga, you seed it into this little board, and then you seat the whole thing back into the socket on the Amiga's motherboard, and that's how it is able to access the video information. And then there's a ribbon cable with a VGA connector that allows you to do double. You can output to the original screen as well as the additional VGA screen. And this is an example of a device that kind of takes it a little further than most of the scan doublers do. Showing you sort of a range of capabilities beyond just scan doubling. This device offers on the Amiga, when you install it, it has some associated software, and it allows the use of several new graphics modes that are native and custom only to the scan doubler itself. It's actually using hardware on the board itself to act as a simple video card. So it's something that the Amiga is not typically capable of. And, as an example, it has a 1024 by 768 display that's significantly higher than, an Amiga with its original chipset would be capable of outputting. You could run this on an old, like an Amiga 500, and you're looking at a very much higher display, but with certain limitations as far as number of colors and the palette size.
I'd be kind of surprised that that it could be supported by the operating system. I mean, like, why can the Amiga keep track of things that are thousands of pixels away?
Well, once the Amiga 2.0 operating system came, and that's when the Amiga left the blue, orange, black, and red aesthetic and moved to this gray, the 2.0 and up visual change in the operating system, there was the support for what the Amiga group calls retargetable graphics. And so there's the standard hardware, anything that's written to the hardware works fine, but when you're in the desktop OS, it allows you to choose, basically, when you're choosing native resolutions on the system, it lists them, and it registers them in the system. The operating system is aware of the limitations in third-party video cards. When they're installed, their software has drivers that then appear in this list as well. So it's with the retargetable graphics, desktop-based applications, you're not talking about assembly language games that were written to the Amiga's hardware, can, they can register their resolutions, and you can run at much higher resolution, higher color scenarios. I've actually had a couple of different video cards, standard, PC style VGA graphics hardware in my Amiga at different times, Amiga 2000, and they registered here, and I could select it. And then, when you browse the web, you have, 16-bit color, that kind of thing. So that's something that came with the updated Amiga OS 2 around 1990. So that this works in the same principle. So effectively, the operating system is handing off the rendering to this, basically a little video card portion of what has been done in this Flickr fixture that has, features you might not expect.
Yeah, I see. So, but essentially, you've got sort of like an alternate computer hand. It's a little bit like a graphics chip, even, or something. Like essentially, you're just saying, make this so, make it happen.
Right.
there are
a number of, and there still are. But there are a lot of video cards. I think there was 20, 30 video cards at different times that could plug into the slotted Amigas, and they would register this way. And yes, it says, okay, so basically, right, when the Amiga 2.0 operating system came out, it said, all right, we have the ability now to, it will do what we're doing, but first, set what the hardware is that we're rendering on. So it separated the rendering, the actual, the drivers for video away from, what it is that made the calls to render the display. So so that was a nice addition to the operating system. Yeah, and so what this has done, in addition, he's got an FPGA on there. The creator of this actually, basically coded a small video card, a chipset that can render. an example, it has the ability at this resolution to render full screen images using 1024x768 with 4096 colors on screen, which is very impressive. That's far beyond what the Amiga can do. A static image, again, that's another capability. Whereas here in the workbench, you're limited to four colors in this mode. There was another mode coded into this device that allows you to, at that resolution, render a static image, with the full 4096 colors on screen, which is again impressive. Another sort of less accessible mode, but it's in the hardware. So that's just not to make the whole thing about the Indivision. That's an example of a scan doubler that is more specific to a platform, but also it brings with it, as a result, a good bit more functionality. But then again, as you point out, you can't pick this up and use it on also the Atari ST or the 2GS or the Archimedes or whatever you might also have in the house. So it wouldn't be the most economical approach if you're trying to go larger scale on this.
It actually does seem like targeting this particular era might be almost more difficult in a way, because the computers were more sophisticated. I mean, when I was thinking about the topic, I was thinking about the Timex Sinclair and stuff like that. Uh-huh. Where there's no chance of trying to make a 4K image or whatever. I mean, but this was far enough along computer development that the idea that there could be different resolution targets was actually a thing.
Yes, I think this device, the Indivision that I've shown here, I think the date of the firmware in mine is 2010. So this was a device that was created, I think within, maybe 15 years ago, but it certainly was well past the Amiga's heyday. This is a kind of an afterpiece. In a moment, I'll mention another much, much more recent device that brings additional features to the table. But right, this is beyond what you would have seen back when the Amiga was actually, especially the early Amigas, were actually doing their thing.
Mm-hmm. I guess what I was thinking was that even the Amiga, it itself was late enough in the development of these, of computer technology that it became sort of obvious that they'd want to be able to, have in the operating system or something some ability to have some flexibility about what's being sent, because there might be a graphics card that's fancier or something like that. Whereas the Apple II, you've got 8192 bytes to work with, and that is the video memory.
Yeah, right. Yeah. I mean, I think it landed a good year after the Amiga, but the Apple IIgs, I mean, it was one and done. There was no significant update to that, but it's operating system that eventually came forth, GSOS. It doesn't allow for other video cards, but a case that sort of falls in between, I guess, the Atari ST, more similar to the Amiga, it did iterate with more variation on the hardware and higher end, higher spec machines, and then their operating system would allow, higher end additional hardware to render for it. I don't believe it was quite as tidily done on an operating system level as what the Amiga did. It's impressive kind of how forward thinking that was, because this tech, picking resolutions, and if your board has registered resolutions, that was like a 1990 piece, so which seems early to me for that, for these systems. But another thing, before I mention this another device, I'm only going to...
You only have 20 left, right?
Yeah, it's only 20 devices left, so this is part one of seven RCR about scan doublers, so we'll break it out later on. But now, I just wanted to mention, and this is something that I don't ever see people talking about, and it's just something to be aware of. So there are certain negatives when you have a scan double system using a 31 kilohertz display versus using the 15 kilohertz display. the systems that use a 50 kilohertz display, they're updating, you know, typically 60 frames a second, you know, NTSC PAL 50 frames a second. These machines, you know, the coders, especially like specifically Amiga, you know, GS, ST, like they're making games and scene demos in assembly language. And, you know, they're pushing the hardware as far as it can. So you often see 60 frame a second, you know, movement on screen. And that's tied to its 50 kilohertz display. When you attach the double scan display and you're doing this caching in memory on the scan doubler of half of the play field and rendering it, you know, every other tick, you know, basically 30 times a second, there are artifacts. And I'm showing on screen some photographs that give an example. On the left, there is a variant of the big, you know, Boeing bouncing ball, where it's, you know, it is what it is. It's somewhat pixelated. It's, you know, it's a still shot, but there's the ball that is moving around. Over on the 31 kilohertz display, it looks very dramatic on this still frame. It's more of a kind of a flicker in your eye that you notice when you're watching it real time. And basically, this is an artifact of you're seeing certain portions of the image, or every other line is being displayed. And that's to do with the delay in caching and the fact that it needs to send some signal out, you know, 60 times a second, or in VGA, it's actually 70 times a second. You know, that is something to just be aware of. I've had people, you know, ask, why do I keep the little 14-inch little Amiga screen in the setup versus just, you know, taking this huge, much, much higher quality Sony monitor and putting it, you know, on top of the Amiga. And that is because when I'm watching, you know, like demo scene productions or games that are just really glass smooth, I prefer looking on CRT because the motion is glass smooth. Say you're just something scrolling across the screen at 60 frames a second, which is typically how things scroll on, you know, games or demos, things like that. They're trying to be as smooth as they can be, which is moving one pixel per frame. On the 31 kilohertz, it looks basically as if there's just a very mild stutter as it only advances that object half of the scans. So basically, it's missing half the frames when something is moving across the screen. And, you know, when it's, these things are usually happening at a pretty good clip from a distance, it's not a big deal, but you can feel it. But it's much more practical to use a modern display, like a modern flat panel. They're much more readily available. You can replace them easily. CRTs are getting harder to find. They're bigger. So these are things that they factor in for me, but they probably aren't a big concern for most people. I know, Paul, you've worked with some scan doublers. Is this a aspect or a negative that bothers you at all, or that you've even noticed?
Well, I mean, I think the computers that I use are lower tech than this, you know.
Okay.
So, I mean, like the Apple II can't drive things that fast anyway. But place that I do that I have run into this kind of thing. I mean, all of this stuff sounds very familiar to anybody who's attempted to like digitize a VHS tape, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, so that's the NTSC broadcast is, you know, I guess that's sort of at least the origin of some of these problems, you know, that it's every mm-hmm. frame is organized into two fields and those fields are interleaved. And
right.
The problem is that each, like if you have like a some sort of motion, like a ball is going across the screen or something like that, the picture advances between those. So you don't actually get 60 frames a second. You get 60 half frames a second, but you can't just merge them because they're capturing different points in time. And so that's why you wind up with these like weird combing effects when you like almost, mm-hmm. there's no good algorithm for doing this. And you know, it kind of worked okay because the phosphors persisted enough that, you know, that was a pretty good way to solve it, you know, that you could have every other line still lit while and fading while you lit the lines in between. But it is terrible to try to convert that stuff. And you know, there's all kinds of fancy algorithms to try to, extrapolate, I don't know, something polite. So one thing people do sometimes do is just throw a field away. Just say, okay, we're just going to use only one field because that will solve all of the motion problems. But then you lose mm-hmm. half the vertical resolution.
So, right. Yeah, I think, and it's interesting, I guess one of the things we've talk so specifically about some of the capabilities of this Indivision device, not to, you know, keep digging into that particular bowl. But yes, the VGA display is actually 70 hertz, and it's you know, storing 60 hertz Amiga information, so it's doing an additional translation there where it's emulating 60 or 50 hertz, translating it to the 70. So that's another step, you know, so that everything, you know, works out in sync. But, you know, I don't know what algorithm he's using, and obviously there is, as you say, there's no perfect algorithm, so that is contributing, you know, in some effect to what's happening. You know, it's quite a transfer of, you know, like, this is one style that's from some time in the distant past, here's a modern display. This device on the Amiga is, you know, VGA out, which is less and less useful. You know, newer devices are, you know, DVI or, of course, HDMI.
But it's interesting that you mentioned the fact that the VGA is possibly getting less useful. I mean, you know, so we have maybe some devices that can convert from our nice composite or you know, sort of fancy proprietary to VGA. But then if you have a monitor that doesn't have VGA anymore, do you need another thing in between, and is that going to introduce its own lag and frame conversion issues? And
I think a lot of the devices I've seen have started making HDMI versions, or, you know, like, you know, taking the opportunity to you know, okay, let's reassess, do a version 2.0, making some changes. So some of the ones that had popularity, I know another scan doubler, and this is not the one that I'm going to briefly show here, but again, a rather more powerful device than simply a scan doubler. That is the scan doubler for the TI-99, which is the F-18A. Or wait, is it F-19A? I always get that wrong.
I think it's F-18, but I don't know. Anyway, it's been discussed on several episodes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
So I'll check our show notes.
Okay. So the F-18 for the TI, the one that I have installed, I mean, it provides higher resolution that can be tapped into by programmers on the TI, resolution and color depth that wasn't there on the original TI. But it is out. It also does the standard scan doubling to output to an LCD. But it the version I have, which is the initial version, is VGA only. And I know that there's one that's being worked on now. Quinn has mentioned it before. I mean, I've read about it. I think she talked about it on either the last show or the one prior, where, I think they're using HDMI, if I'm remembering correctly.
But although that sort of makes the point in a way that, like, if there was a VGA one that was made and then the person said, all right, I'm not doing this anymore, I'm going to go live in the mountain, you're stuck with a VGA thing and you have to get from VGA. You can't just hope that there'll be an HDMI version someday.
Oh, yeah. So. Yeah, no, I agree. Most of the scan doublers that have come and gone have indeed come and gone.
Yeah.
Like, they're not being updated. You know, the Indivision, individual computers, who makes it, I don't know if you're aware of that group, but he's been making a great deal of custom hardware for the Amiga and various other systems, you know, for you know, maybe 15-20 years, and so there's some momentum. You know, I guess it's easier for a group, you know a little operation like that to, you know, occasionally update a product, but yeah, it's, you know, it's certainly not the norm. That's certainly not the norm. And it's not as if they're giving you a replacement. You know, you bought that, even if you have access to buy another one and install it and remove the other one, you know, you can't, like, just reconnect a different cable to it.
Yeah.
I've been spending time with the other item that I have recently purchased, which is the VidHD for the Apple II. And we've talked about this at some length. I was beta testing this a little bit longer than a year back, and I had a beta test unit, but I finally was able to get on the list, and I have a production unit. And it's a little card that plugs into the any slotted Apple II. And we've explained this before, and we've given the details. I'm going to give a quick nutshell. Basically, it's a small combination, a device that's a combo of a number of little microcontrollers. I think it's using an Orange Pi as the CPU unit. It provides HDMI output, but it has capabilities beyond what you might expect for the most basic of a scan doubler. On board, it emulates in its software and hardware all of the video modes of all of the Apple IIs, including the 2GS, which means that demonstrably it can display any of those modes on any of the machines. I have a video I put together and discussed a while ago where the Total Replay game compilation that 4AM and Cucumba have put together is running in attract mode, showing on my Apple IIe. It's on the flat panel display. It actually shows Apple IIgs mode box art that has been scanned in, you know, as part of the package. So that's impressive. More recently, there has been some crazy text modes that have been added to the device. I think you can get like 280 characters wide across on your HDMI display, and you can go crazy with, you know, if you really want a BBS, like you're looking out an open window or something, you can really open up that text window. But it's gaining some capabilities, and beyond just, you know, converting Apple IIe video from, you know, composite to HDMI. And interestingly, the way it does it, as which we've mentioned before, is it is basically sits in a slot and it listens to what's happening on the Apple II bus, and it uses that to recreate in its own memory and in its own you know, computer on board what's happening in video memory of the unit specified. So I was installing this. I took some photographs, basically replacing the old with the new. It's just a very small device. There's actually a Wi-Fi capability and an antenna on the device, but it's not something that is tapped into at this point. And from what I understand, it's not something that a simple firmware update can enable. But it's, you know, there's interesting extra hardware sitting on the board, but that's not being utilized right now.
Though, yeah, I mean, I guess that's sort of an interesting side effect of just like using a kind of off the shelf. You know, it's the VidHD is a couple of different things kind of like stuck together, but, you know, so it doesn't use all of the things that one of those could have used, but.
Right. I think he's, you know, John Brooks has tried to, yeah, I mean, you look at what's out there, what makes sense to put together in an economical way. This, you know, what he's chosen in this latest iteration has that capability, but, you know. And of course, it's always, you know, amusing to stop and think of how many orders of magnitude more powerful this display adapter is than the host hardware into which it is being inserted for the purpose of extending its capabilities and lifetime. But yeah, it's you can, of course, use the VidHD to output to a panel while maintaining your composite screen, if you like. And the VidHD has some very nice sort of different methods of emulating kind of the NTSC artifacted nature of the Apple II display, you know, where you can have it look like it's video coming out of a 2GS, where the colors are a little different. You can use simulating NTSC at PAL as best you can, which adds a little more fuzz to the image. It's very nice. And, you know, you can simulate scan lines. I typically use, there's a kind of a light scan line simulation mode, which kind of makes it feel a little more authentic to the original, but still working on your new display. Mm-hmm. So it's a great device. I guess I've talked about ones that go well beyond just the scan doubling, and many people would be happy to add extra capabilities to their, you know, vintage machines. I certainly, like, you know, look forward to exploring the text modes on this the VidHD, which I've only, you know, began to play with last night.
Yeah, and I guess like with a lot of these things, like if you're going to try to you do something with it, for the most part your audience is yourself. You know, so like you don't like the fact that you have a text mode that few other people have, even though it's maybe not that few.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. You know, there have been some on the Apple II Slack. There are some folks that have been programming. It's a small community, you know, but like so many different things, there are expanders for, you know, like some of the 8-bit Ataris that completely expand their audio processing speed, video capabilities. But it's really only that small group, you know, of people that have them that can actually, you know, the audience is so small that yes, you are kind of on your own. There are demos here and there, but, you know, it's we're not a practical group, the retro computing lunatics, I suppose. So that's about what I've experienced in the last my hour of talking. So I apologize. I feel like I should apologize for that. So anyway.
Well, I was going to say we've been getting a fair bit of comments as well. So maybe I'll start go through those.
Okay.
So early thing, three to two pull down is actually more about changing frame rate. If you're trying to get between frame rates like PAL and film and NTSC, that's where that comes in less for interlacing issues, but it's still, video is terrible. Basically is the nutshell version of all of this. But let's see. So the correct number for the F blank A is indeed F18A. This is Josh who mentioned that. And Matt mentioned the ZX-HD for the ZX Spectrum, which does a similar kind of thing. And there's actually a couple of these suggestions in the comments of other things that are sort of like this that will add extra video mode. So the ZX-HD does this.
Very cool.
For the ZX Spectrum. And I think there's a Coco VGA or something like that. Yeah, for the Coco. So there are quite a number of these kind of like individual computer specific solutions, which is great if you are a dedicated somethingist, and not so great if you're trying to be a generalist. And because I have a Coco or two. I would kind of like to use this, but I don't know if I want, the Coco VGA and the ZX HD and the Vid HD and the Amiga things and so forth. And I guess a little bit of pushback on calling some of these things scan doublers, since they're doing much more than that. But
right. Yeah. I think at the core of what we were talking about, that this is what I looked at is, okay, how do you get video out of these old machines? And at the core, there's a scan doubler and the flicker fixer. But certainly, wasn't trying to slight any of the devices. But I guess there's that at the core, and then they all have their different. I mean, some even have, audio, they're adding audio features. So yeah, I don't.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it does seem like it's a pretty, pretty big industry. And I think it's kind of a fun project as a retro computer enthusiast to design one of these things too, I imagine. So that's probably why there are so many of these. But okay. Earl wants to push back and has patiently waited to tell us to stop trying to to replace our CRTs with something different.
Well, technically yes, although I have to admit there's a lot of reasons why CRTs are not good, or downsides of CRTs. Blake mentioned a couple of them. They're big, they're bulky, they're they're prone to fail, and they're getting older. And they're not making new ones, so we've got what we've got at the moment. I guess maybe there is a certain amount of niche CRT manufacturing from just the little research I did on this, but
it seems to be the case.
By and large, they're pretty much gone. And also, they shoot out little pesky rays at your eyeballs, and there's just a variety of things of CRTs that aren't optimal, and is probably why we don't use CRTs anymore. But that's the case for a lot of the things that we have on our retro computers. A lot of work has been done emulating floppy drives, stuff from the GoTech and beyond. It gives us modern replacements, because not so much the floppy drives were dying, but because the floppy disks were dying. And also, it just seems like almost nobody cares about printers anymore. There have been some replacement parts for that plotter that was OEM'd by a lot of manufacturers, like the Atari and Commodore. And I think it's the same basic printer plotter device, right? That little tabletop unit. But
I think we discovered that. Yeah.
Yeah, but by and large, I think dot matrix printers, nobody cares. It's kind of what I've found, although I kind of like them, but not a ton of work going on in restoring or coming up with an alternative for those at the moment. So back to the CRTs, and I'll just say real quick, I have seven CRTs of different kinds in my collection. Two are Commodore monitors, and they're a little general purpose because they've got the RGB mode also. One's just a flat-out old Admiral TV. And one of them is a VGA monitor, one of the last ones that were being made before we switched over to flat screen. So I feel lucky in that regard because it's still fairly quote-unquote new. And then a couple of terminals that I have. Five of the seven work, and one of them is going to be a simple repair. And the seventh one, an old terminal, I don't know how much trouble that's going to be to get back on its feet. But I know that to a certain extent, you can do it. These things were so simple in their guts that fixing them is just a matter of capacitors or resistors or something like that. About the only fatal failure mode is if the tube itself is bad. If it's just too tired or it's got horrific burn-in or something like that, you can still fix them. Now, one of the channels that I watch on YouTube, Adrian's Digital Basement, he spends a lot of time rejuvenating CRTs, fixing the components that have gone bad, dialing them in with the adjustments that they have on the inside, the, you know, those little things that you can't tune with a metal screwdriver. You have to use a plastic screwdriver and turn those little pots inside, and you can get the thing going again. And I've really enjoyed watching the restoration work that he's done. Now, here's another thing that makes CRTs not optimal is that the voltages within them are really dangerous. So just your standard retro person probably shouldn't open them up and start poking your hands in there because you're going to get zapped and knocked across the room. It was one of the things that they really cautioned us when I went to Apple repair school, because I actually was a Macintosh, authorized repair professional. And when we got inside the old, the old classic Macs, like the Mac Plus, and that, one of the first things they taught us was how to discharge the anode inside the tube, because it'll zap you pretty bad.
I remember, Earl, just briefly, I just foolishly, you know, my parents would not have been happy to know what was happening in that bedroom, but like, I guess I had an Atari. I was 14 and I was adjusting. I had bought Radio Shack, the little plastic, you know, yellow, green, red CRT tools, mm-hmm. in the nifty little shirt pocket sleeve, and I had looked online. The vertical height was a little off on my Atari ST's screen. So I opened it up and, you know, like, don't touch it. You know, don't touch the tube. It's very important. And, you know, I was reaching through and I could feel a tingling on my arm as I got near the picture tube. Mm-hmm. And I went online and I'm like on IRC or whatever and said, are you supposed to feel a tingling? It's like, well, that's not good. You know, why don't you? Yeah. So I adjusted it and I didn't touch it. But I have a friend of mine in the neighborhood, also, you know, an Apple geek at the time. His father worked for a while doing independent, you know, like, you know, hardware repair, computer repair, and he inadvertently touched the tube. And from what I understand it, you know, he was briefly hospitalized with a irregular heartbeat, you know, from the enormous discharge on that picture tube. So yeah, you make a good point. Those things can kill you, you know, like
not to minimize, you can die from doing the wrong thing.
You can die
in a CRT.
Yeah, that's so right.
Just saying, you know, that's
yeah.
So I've spent a lot of time arguing against CRTs. So what's in favor of them? And no. I think probably the best thing for me is just the look. I don't think anything else that I've seen gives me the same feel with a retro computer as if I'm using one of the old CRT monitors. It looks like it looked back in the day. Even if it's something that has VGA output, for instance, I made this little board. The heart of it's an ESP32, one of those little Wi-Fi microcontrollers. And I used some plans that I found online, and I made something that's almost a spot-on duplicate of a VT100 terminal. It was really cool. But I plugged it in to one of my LCD monitors that has VGA, and it looked horrible. And I thought, what's going on here? And I realized it was the upscaling. A lot of folks do realize that when you've got an LCD monitor, it has an optimal resolution. it's got an optimal number of dots on it. And if you, it will support if you use another video mode, but it will do its own internal upscaling or adjustment of that video mode to the optimal resolution. And sometimes that looks horrible. So I took the LCD panel off and I stuck a VGA mod or a CRT modder onto this project that I built, and it looked beautiful. And that has been the case with a lot of the upscalers I've seen. Sometimes you get, like you were talking about, Blake, the blocky concept where you've upscaled something, say, from composite to an HD screen. It has a composite input, and you plug it in, but when you do, you find that it doesn't look very good because you've got that hard, blocky sort of appearance that you don't get on a regular CRT. And that's why, I guess, for a while at least, I would say, let's not throw out all the CRTs. I do understand, you know, and by the way, pretty much I think everywhere these days, if you do have a CRT that you want to get rid of, and it's not something that's fixable, that you can recycle it and should recycle it, should take it to an official place and turn it in for recycling so it doesn't mess up the environment.
Or mail it to Earl.
Yeah, or if it doesn't work, please don't do that. If it does work, maybe, depending. I have enough. I'm actually full at the moment. But that's my. I just don't think anything duplicates a CRT was the point I was trying to make. But I do realize all the downsides, and I know why people are building these solutions to get away from CRTs. I just still like them.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I would. I think I will probably still like them, you know, forever as long as they work. But I'm just in the process of moving and things like that, and I'm looking at these big TVs, and I'm thinking, well, you know, I'm going to hurt myself taking this out of this apartment to the next place. And it's going to work for, you know, 4 more years or something. I'm looking, you know, right now physically at this relatively giant CRT, you know, which is a television, but, you know, I have my 2C Plus hooked up to it, and, you know, Total Replay looks pretty cool on it and that kind of thing. So.
Yeah. I get really excited about, you know, like the Total. I've had so much fun with you know, VidHD and Total Replay together. Actually, they're kind of a nice thing, and it's great. But I have no desire or plan to take that, you know, that 13-inch CRT composite off that Apple IIe. You know, it definitely, it's for all the clean, you know, displays, and in some cases 80 columns, like the TI now has an 80 column display because of the F18A. You know, it still doesn't look, when you're doing anything other than 80 columns, you know, it doesn't have that same feel, you know. So I guess the answer ideally is you use both flat panel, and so you can just double the amount of real estate that your vintage computer is using.
I mean, the reality is, eventually these things will all die. All the CRTs will die just because the tubes don't last forever.
Yeah, no, that's true. I mean, it's silly not to acknowledge that, you know. And I think, as we've all echoed before, you see something come along, like, you know, this Spectrum, the video enhancement for the ZX Spectrum, the VidHD. The new F18A Plus or whatever is coming, maybe you're using that CRT now, but they are going to die, and people are going to be making these things forever, necessarily, and almost certainly, you know. So it's kind of worthwhile keeping an eye out. Like, if you see something and you don't actually need it now, and, you know, you have the ability, it might be a good purchase to get while you can, because this stuff comes and goes. And
sometimes when it's gone, it's gone. I was just reading a blog that weirdly, it was kind of strange that it quoted me. And I was like, oh, okay, that's kind of weird. But the blog was talking about that concept that you just said, that sometimes things in the retro world are just available for a limited period of time. They're hobby projects. That's just, you know, that's okay. That's just the reality of what it is. But if you see it and you're thinking, I might want to get that. Just know that if you decide not to, that, you know, that's fine. In a lot of cases, that's the right decision anyway. Don't just buy everything, but it might not be around forever. Sometimes they become unobtainium later.
Right. And so these things aren't necessarily cheap. You know,
right.
They're actually, generally speaking, they're not as bad as you might think. Like, a lot of the projects that I've purchased recently are pretty, I consider them to be pretty well priced, some less than others. But, you know, I know Quinn has, I think she's mentioned a number of times, I think she has picked up, you know, two or three devices for the slotted Apple II, or, you know, I think she picked up, she's on the list for a TI F18A, you know, Mark II. She doesn't have any slotted Apple IIs, you know, if I recall, you know, but she, you know, seems like it would be a good thing to have. I heard someone, you know, they don't make the renowned CFFA 3000, the floppy and hard drive emulator for the slotted IIs that had a few runs. Someone on IRC the other day said, oh yeah, he had his new inbox one he never opened. He's now going to put it in his safe deposit box for retirement, you know, like they could sell it off at $10,000 20 years from now. So things come and go, and that's one of the things that has gone.
And I think, I mean, like, it's not impossible that somebody could make a new one that is as good. It turns out that, you know, that particular thing did a couple of things that there aren't any sort of current analogs for, but you know, it wasn't impossible because it was done.
Right. No, sure, sure.
So I'm not sure that putting it in the safety deposit box is a good idea, just because 3 years down the road, when a better thing is available and everybody's bought it, then nobody's going to want the old CFFA 3000.
That's a good point.
Okay, so I think I probably am not going to contribute too much here. I'll jump in on the topic, you know, like next time we bring it up with other people too. But I got one thing that came up in the stream chat was the RetroTINK. Does anyone know the RetroTINK?
I don't have one personally, but some of the YouTubers that I watch use it, and they have comments about it, both its advantages and challenges.
I'm not familiar.
Yeah, I hadn't been familiar with it before it was mentioned in the chat, but it looks like a relatively general purpose.
It is.
You know, video converter. And another one that I do want to talk about in the future, I think, is these GONBUS boards, converters, the GBS 8200 and the like, because I think there are things that we can say about that too. Those are more general. And at Kansas Fest 2020, there were a couple of talks. One was me talking about Apple III stuff, and one of the things that I had mentioned in there was how I was getting video from the Apple III to something I could capture. And there I was using a couple of fairly you know, low key boxes. You know, so one is AV2 HDMI, which is it'll get you from composite to HDMI. And you know, this is one of those things where if you look on Amazon, you will see 30 different things that are, you know, they all look identical, but they're from different manufacturers, and you know, they're presumably all manufactured in the same place in China somewhere. This one seemed to work pretty well for me. And you know, then I had a separate like HDMI input box that worked. Although for the thing I was doing, the lag was incredibly long. I mean, like it was, it was almost like minutes between when I typed something and when it appeared on the screen sometimes, but and particularly when I tried to then get it through OBS. And actually also, Alexander Jacox and, you know, that same event had a pretty good overview of some various ways to do modern video on. This was sort of Apple II focused, but you know, the Apple II presents particular challenges in a way because it's doing NTSC, but it's cheating a little bit. In our chat comments, Josh mentions that the RetroTINK is a zero lag line doubler, is what that is supposed to be. So.
Interestingly, physically similar to one of the devices that you were talking about there, Paul. Mm-hmm. I forgot. I guess it's sort of part of this conversation, but we our plasma wall panel died, and sadly they don't make plasmas anymore, and that was painful. So I replaced it, and whereas that one had component in, among other inputs, I have a component cable on my Wii. It only has composite in, and I can't find the composite cable for the Wii, so I bought one of those that converts, it converts a component down to composite, which with a tier, and then that plugs into the TV for, you know, current TV has a lot of digital inputs and just a composite input, so I can use the Wii on that. So that's kind of a different case, a sad case, but a different case.
I guess in general, one of the challenges with these things are, even in the old NTSC days, you still had a lot of variations. Like you mentioned, Paul, the Apple II played tricks with NTSC to get it to work. So sometimes these devices don't play well with that because it's not a quote-unquote, what would I say? It doesn't exactly meet the NTSC standard for the video. And then you mentioned component video, and the Commodore 64 had a mode where you could split the Luma and the Chroma, which really, it improved the sharpness a lot.
Basically, S-video,
what do you
yeah.
do with that in one of these upscaling or, you know, conversion devices? So even within the realm of the composite devices, there were still some variations on a theme that might make it tricky to have a truly universal device.
Like Paul, I wasn't familiar with the Zero Tink, but Retro Tink, but looking at it, from what I saw, it looks like it has, I think I saw an S-video connector. It looks like it is quite the wide array of outputs and or inputs. I definitely intend to look further into it because, yeah, there are general needs that, you know, I still will have soon, I'm sure.
Yeah, and it would be nice to be able to just sort of have a thing that you could try, you know, even if later you get a fancy platform-specific thing.
Right.
Cool. Okay, so when we talked 2 months ago or whatever about like using this as a topic, several people weighed in on like having things to say, and some of those people are not here. So I think we'll continue to talk about these things into the future.
I've got a lot more I want to say about it next show. I've got about another hour,
awesome.
So I'll get ready with that. Yeah.
Cool. Yeah, no, I mean, there's a ton, and this is, I mean, it's one of the big issues that we have. I mean, like, you know, video and media storage, I think, are the two big things.
We've almost nailed the media thing. There's so many solutions for so many platforms out there that we've almost got that one nailed.
If it weren't for those pesky capacitors, I mean, I think we'd be we'd be set set for the forever.
Yeah, I guess. Well, I mean, there are indeed also the chip failures that happen inside the computers. There, what is it, PLA or something that you often want to need to replace in the Commodore? Is that what
it is? Two or three different chips in the various Commodores.
The PAL,
the PLA chip dies a lot. The SID chip gets really hot and that can die. The TED chip, I think, in the 16 and the plus 4 can. It, you know, is one of the failure mode chips.
Yeah. On the Apple II disk drive, they have a signal amplifier chip that's used, which is, you know, sort of critical to making the thing work. And that will fail after a while. Or it has, you know, like I've had to replace a couple of those if you really ride your drives hard, you know. I just recently saw, got a couple of keyboard encoder replacements for the Apple III from Joe's Computer Museum. Joe Strohsnyder had made a couple of those, and apparently these are things that are more static sensitive than anything else on the Apple III board, according to someone on the Facebook group. So I got a couple of those, assuming that I'm going to blow at least a couple of these in the future.
Right.
But
the hardware failures, example I had that was very painful, power supply failures. Typically, that's power supply failed, you know, maybe a little smoke, but, you know, it's dead. Now you're going to replace it. But on the case, and anyone who is Atari 8-bit savvy, I know Jack would certainly know the dark dangers here. Right. I had an 800 Atari 800 XL and a 130 XC, and they shared a power supply, and I went and turned one on after like 9 months. I hadn't turned it on, and had a little screen lit up, and then it went dark. I thought, let me try it on the other machine. So I turned it on, exact same thing, and it was the what's known as the ingot power supply on the. There are several power supplies for the Atari 8-bit computers. One of them is, it's shaped like a gold ingot, whereas the base, it's rectangular. It's, I guess it's a trapezoid, a three-dimensional, I don't know what you call a three-dimensional trapezoid, whatever the case, it's rectangular-ish, and the top is a slightly smaller than the bottom.
Right.
And it's apparently, if you see one of those in your house, and it is for a home computer, the Atari, not for the drive, but the Atari, you just cut the cable right off of it and then throw it in the trash. because when it fails in such a way that it fries the RAM in the system that you've got it plugged in. So it killed two machines in less than 5 minutes. I've shelved those, and I'll repair them eventually, maybe. But I ended up replacing them both. And I threw away all the, I had four ingot power supplies in the house that I cut the cable off and threw them in the garbage.
It's a good PSA, I think, also for the Commodore 64s, that with the old brick power supply for the C64s, that apparently, and I've never experienced this, but apparently it had a failure mode where it would put significantly more than 5 volts on the 5-volt rail when it died. So it wasn't just the power supply that would go up. It's like what you were just saying, Blake. It would take the computer with it. There are a couple of possibilities of dealing with this. One is there's actually a Commodore 64 saver that apparently you can put in line. And if it notices that the power spikes like that, it will attempt to stop it. But the more common way seems to be just to buy a modern replacement power supply for the C64 that doesn't have that it might kill your computer aspect to it.
I there were some people pointed out, there's some, USB style power supplies that could be wired to do it. But it also was mentioned to me, I think it was Kay that pointed out that typically all of the other A8 power supplies, I mean, they'll fail, but they almost never fail in a destructive way for the machine. Like, it's pretty much okay to let it fail. So I just picked up on eBay a couple of used units. But yeah, the best solution if you, would go new, and I think... Paul's showing
it feels eBay item there. Safer to go new. I found a eBay auction for one of these like trip over voltage protection things for the Commodore 64 and VIC-20 plus 4
a fuse, I guess, basically, or something like that.
But it's frightening actually, because I do have a big pile of computers that I am gonna someday want to test. And some of them have bricks like that. Actually, I was thinking when you said an ingot power supply, I wasn't thinking about the shape. I was thinking, and I forget if these are Ataris or Commodores or whose, but there's one set of power supplies where the internals are all, they're locked in some sort of like epoxy or something like that. Like you're,
I think that was the Commodore. Yeah. I think they were potted.
I know what you mean. Right.
Does not seem like, not only can you not fix them, but it doesn't seem like that would be that healthy for a power supply anyway. It's like, okay, heat, stay here.
Right. Yeah, that's a strange-looking thing.
Let's see. All right, so maybe I will move on to the listener feedback. There's a couple sort of like feedback items I'll mention. As before, I will probably not get to many feedback items, but the first feedback I'll mention is Peter wrote over email to point out that there is a an official Lego NES kit now. I don't know. I thought that was kind of cool. I don't usually follow Lego, so I wouldn't have noticed this. But had you guys seen this before our feedback?
Not before the feedback. No, that's very cool.
$230 available now. It has a. It's pretty detailed. It has a little TV. TV has a, it says low tech, is as if it was badged, branded low tech, but and it has a little Mario on it. Looks pretty good.
Can you move the Mario? It looks like he's on a boom.
Oh, you're right. It does seem like it's on a little plastic arm of some sort.
Yeah.
That's funny. I did not investigate it too carefully to know, but it, I suspect you are right. It does look like, oh, it's got, got a wind up thing on the end.
Oh, maybe
that's hilarious.
I couldn't quite make out what the video outputs were. Is that composite or is that component?
That's very cool. But, yeah, I mean, you know, in a sense, it's not that much different from like a 3D printed thing, except that it has occasional places that you can connect a brick or something, I guess. Still, it's kind of neat. It's also kind of neat because it's official Lego.
Oh, and it looks like from the comments that when you turn the crank, the background scrolls.
Cool. Okay, let's see. Next thing, Frank wrote over email to point out Retro Rewind. It's a storefront that is selling Commodore-related modern equipment, basically. Frank said it was started about 6 months ago. This is Frank's store, but it's of interest to our listenership. So started about 6 months ago, covers Commodore 64, Commodore 128, 16 and plus 4 and Amiga stuff. If things that you wondered about or heard about earlier today about the Amiga intrigued you, here's more things you can get for the Amiga. I don't know if none of these, I think, were referred to earlier today, but I think they're all sort of modern solutions for various things.
Actually, I think one of them on the screen there is the RGB to HDMI adapter. Is that at the bottom on the right?
Yes, yeah.
Oh, that might be the thing that requires that's the thing that requires a Raspberry Pi Zero to plug into it.
Ah, neat. Okay, so.
Yeah, so that was, I think, what I was talking about. And there we have the link.
Very nice. cool. So, anyway, yeah, it looks nice. If you are in the Commodore world and were not aware of this, then definitely check it out because it looks like there's a fair number of sort of diagnostic things too. You know, if you're in the Commodore world and have a broken Commodore, then this could be sort of useful.
It's a cleanly done store. I like it.
Yeah, it's nice. It's a good service. I noted it was in the address is retrorewind.ca, and it's actually based in Toronto, which I thought was going to be handy for Carrington due to his voracious appetite for acquiring Commodore things.
Yeah, for all his Commodore needs.
His fondness for Commodore, old chicken head himself.
Yeah, but anyway, it looks good. So anything... Anyone else wanted to say about it? I don't know, Earl, had you seen this before? I think I asked you that before and you hadn't.
I've scrolled through the store but didn't have anything specific else to say about it.
I'd not seen it.
Cool. Okay, Dan wrote over email to point out... We talked some time ago, a couple episodes ago, about the... I don't know, various things having to do with trying to archive things in the present for the future. And there was an episode of the podcast 99% Invisible called Game Over. It was actually from some years ago, 2015, it looks like. But it was sort of about the end of The Sims Online, kind of documenting, you know, what happened as they pulled the plug on this online community. You know, it relates to the questions about kind of archiving things like that. So
the fleeting now.
Mm-hmm. I've listened to a couple of episodes of this. I know it's a very popular podcast, so maybe other people will already have come across it, but I believe that it must be good given the degree to which it is recommended and wins awards and things like that. So check that out, Game Over. It's always nice to see retro topics in mainstream places too.
Definitely.
Let's see. Herb wrote somewhere, Facebook, I think.
Yeah.
He'd found an Atari PS3000 monitor, which I think we'd mentioned this
on a previous
episode. Yeah, it's an Atari monitor that has a disk drive built in.
It's so odd. It always seems so strange to me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think as I recall, this was sort of like in the background of a photo or something like that. That it was like.
Yeah.
But this is an auction that has many pictures of like what it looks like inside and out. And it occurs to me that this is another one of those fleeting now moments that, this is a lot of photos of a lot of detail of this monitor, and someone should capture those before they go away, because they will leave eBay at some point. So,
actually,
so Blake, get clicking.
It's the time for me to saddle up and jump onto Pinterest.
That's right. I think it might be.
I guess it might be. Yeah, you're right. Think how useful that'll be down the road. I mean, somebody's going to be searching.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. 2000 internal flyback failure. Yeah.
When they're fixing their CRT.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think I probably made the comment at the time, too, that it does seem like, I mean, there's a funny sort of set of instructional videos. I mean, they're not intrinsically funny, but instructional videos for the Apple III. You know, like, this is how you use your Apple III, and it's sort of like a VHS collection, and it had little beeps, you know, where you're supposed to pause it and then do the thing they talked about, and then come back and hit play again and so forth. And but one of the things they said, you know, when you're originally setting it up, is, you know, be sure you put your TV, you know, with this tape in it, on the left side of the Apple III, like the side that's furthest away from the disk drive. Which I thought was pretty cool, but also
the real down, you know, where the metal hits the road advice there, you know.
That's right. But that additionally makes it seem extra weird to put, like, okay, we're gonna force you to have the disk drive as close to the monitor as possible.
Right.
By building it in.
That's funny. Yeah.
And then I think the last one I'll mention in this round is Anthony posted on Facebook the fact that the Amiga show, which you might almost think RCR has turned into, but at any rate, the Amiga show has reached episode 3. And I didn't actually know there was an episode 1. Part of what I'm saying, I guess, is that there is the Amiga show channel, and it's something like half hour episodes of, you know, sort of reviews of things Amiga, contemporary things. This particular first episode centered around July 1985, but it's all produced on an Amiga, which is, I mean, one of the things that's kind of notable about it, you know. So it's got archival footage and things like that, but it's all sort of put together with an Amiga. So if you hadn't heard of that, as I hadn't, check that out. It's kind of neat. It's very, very calmly narrated. Blake, had you seen this before?
Well, I certainly didn't know it was made, you know, edited with Amigas. I'd wandered into conversations at the tail end of conversations about it on IRC. I didn't fully get what it was. This is a new thing, 3 episodes. I guess the thought is it will continue. I mean, this is a new YouTube. Okay. And each episode, what does it look like? About half an hour, 25 minutes.
Yep. Centered on a month. So episode 3 is July 1985.
Yeah, well, cool. That's certainly to me.
I think episode 3 is January 1986. Episode 1 is July 1985.
Yeah. Nice.
But they're well produced. I mean, like, you know, I didn't actually watch it all the way through, but I sort of sampled a couple of these, and looks neat, you know. And it's a neat project. I mean, I'm sure a huge amount of time went into this, but actually doing something on like this on the Amiga, you know, which is sort of that's like a hard mode.
That's commitment.
So
yeah. Like Info Magazine, do you remember? They used to make it on the Amiga. I mean, it was a Commodore 64 magazine, but then when desktop publishing came to the Amiga, they would make the whole magazine on the Amiga, and that was kind of a notable thing, and also an extraordinarily difficult and frustrating thing, apparently.
Right. Yeah. Hopefully people appreciated it.
But. Yeah.
All right. So I'll leave the feedback there. I don't know how long we've been recording, but it's some time. Oh,
it's been a while, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, we might want
to... Getting close to the point where we're going to have a break for ads, but first, items of interest and news. And Blake is going to talk to us about the Amiga.
I'll be quick. What I found is it's an Amiga 1100, new awesome Amiga 1000 mainboard. And what it is... basically a replacement motherboard for the Amiga 1000 and again, it's just sort of a limited, as I think I mentioned when we talked about the 1000 last show, it, you know, there's not a huge number of people driving Amiga 1000s right now, even within the retro computing community. But it has some advances. It has a 6820 at twice the speed of the Amiga. It's same original chipset. You need to bring your own. Double the graphics RAM. It has, you know, a lot of standard RAM. That's the standard Amiga expansion connector, which is unsurprising, but it also has a an Amiga 1200 connector, which theoretically would let you use more recent accelerators, 6860s, that kind of thing. The thing about it is, some diehard Amiga 1000 people have had options not unlike this to augment their boards with super invisible unicorn rare add-on boards. But this, it looks like, from what I can tell, it's not, at least currently, slated for production. I guess somebody created it. Distribution is not planned. I guess it could happen, but it's interesting. It's twice as fast as a stock Amiga 1200. So the market is a little bit small. Maybe that's part of, maybe this someone just wanted it for themselves, but it seems like it's gone quite a far way down. I mean, the board looks like it's, it doesn't look like, it certainly wasn't wired together by hand. So I don't know. We'll see. That could be something that I might be interested in if it actually were to, come to market. But so, yes, the other item that I have is just a quick mention that, I know we've talked about Total Replay, I think the last on this show as well, but I think it was mentioned that a beta came out a few months ago, which added a lot of games to the list. But just a couple of days ago, on the 12th or the 13th, there is a new version. The final 4.0 version has been released, and it brings with it three new games. And so there's now a total of 336 games contained in the Total Replay package. So that is about all I have for items and interested news. I wanted to just put those together since they were short.
Cool. Yeah. And for those listening to this as it appears on the feed, the 12th and 13th referred to February 2021.
Yes.
Even though it is August right now. but yeah, no, I mock my slowness in editing, but okay, let's see, Earl, you have the next thing.
Well, it's interesting, we're kind of going through themes today.
Mm-hmm.
One of the themes seems to be build your own, so I've got three links that I put in here for three different videos in which people build a retro computer from scratch. One is, and I didn't go through the links that this video included, but apparently you can get the pieces that you need to build a ZX Spectrum out of parts, which is really cool. In another one of the videos that I linked, Jan Bita, one of the YouTubers that I watch pretty much consistently everything that he puts out, there are reproduction C64 motherboards that are out now, and so you can buy those, and you can collect up the parts, and you can build a C64, at least the main board of a C64, from scratch. And I think there are people who put out kits of parts for this as well, and again, some of the links to that may be in his video. I really enjoyed him building this up. Now, it gets down to the actual chip level. I mentioned before some of the chips that were Commodore custom chips, and they're tough to find, and people are making modern-day replacements based on either ARM or FPGA or some other creative techniques. They, in a lot of cases, they function very much, if not exactly, like the original chip. The SID is hard because the sound chip in the Commodore 64 was a combination of digital and analog components, and purists who listen to the sound out of a SID chip can even tell you which of the many SID chip varieties that you're listening to just by hearing the sound that's coming out of it. So trying to make a modern replacement of that that's perfect is tough, but people are trying. Anyway, the point being, you can build a Commodore 64 main board from scratch. And you can even get modern replacement ships for some of the ones in there that are hard to find. And then finally, that's really the cool. Last. Yeah, it's really neat. And
I mean,
and
it's a nice black, black PCB too.
Well, I think that PCB actually came in multiple colors, okay. If I remember right. I think there were multiple flavors for that.
For something that you will then hide away in a case.
Well, unless you have a transparent case, which I think he puts this into.
Yes. That's a good idea.
To the end here.
And yes, I see in the video it does. That's exactly how this was. That's, you need both of those things together. I think if you're going to build this, you really want to be able to see it and point to it at parties.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Be the first on your block. The third video that I linked to, even more incredible, you can build an Altair 8800 from scratch. Now, some of the pieces of this are modern day reproductions, but as it's put on the site, Mike, who put this all of this together, calls it the Altair 8800C. Mm-hmm. And this is completely built from modern day, including the CPU board, which if you go to eBay right now, you can find a bare printed circuit board that is a replica of an Altair CPU board. And you can also find in another auction a complete kit of parts that you need for that CPU board, the CPU board being one of the boards that you need for the Altair, the brains of the operation, as it were. You also need a disk controller and RAM and that kind of thing, but you can get modern reproductions for those as well. So this may not be, well, it won't be 100% identical to an Altair that you would have bought back in the day, but it is functionally identical and will run all the same software and is less likely to fail and isn't intrinsically, oh, that's interesting. Sorry about that. That's interesting. My Yeti mount decided it was tired. Hang on.
Yeah, it's interesting. I was looking at the bit of the video that was on the screen a second ago. There has a couple of like little tiny cages, which made me think. Yeah, you know, I guess one thing that might be missing from this are like the giant capacitors and the power transformers and things that, you know, makes this new one maybe less likely to catch fire fill your house with smoke.
That's exactly what it is. These are, I can't remember the name for the manufacturer of those power supplies. Meanwell, I think, is the manufacturer. And these are modern-day switching replacements for the ginormous transformer and capacitors in the linear power supplies that you will have in a traditional S100 system. But they give the same voltages, and they're reliable, and they're modern day, and like you say, Paul, they're less likely to catastrophically explode or light on fire. Those old big electrolytic capacitors can actually pack quite a wallop if they blow.
Yeah,
I saw an S100 case that I was looking in that it had a catastrophic capacitor failure, and there was this singed black circle on the inside top of the case that you could tell something bad had happened at some point. Bada boom.
Oh, machine, you have stories.
But anyway, I think it's fun that you can build all these modern day recreations in a lot of cases using modern parts. You can get the feel of the retro computer, but have something that will be more potentially enduring.
Yeah. I know I definitely had that thought with, like, the Apple III Plus by itself, you know, being slightly more enduring possibly than the Apple III and the modern power supply in the Apple III Plus, so it would be less likely to, you know, fill my apartment with smoke. But okay, let's see. I guess I'm next. I'm going to stick with just one thing, which is this. I haven't actually played much with this, but I came across this a post about this. I don't think it's necessarily a new thing. It's apparently already at version 3.6, but it's called BMC64. It's bare metal C64. It's a version basically of the Vice emulator that runs bare metal on a Raspberry Pi. So it doesn't have the whole like Linux operating system underneath it. It's basically just giving access to the Raspberry Pi hardware to Vice. And so there's a version of it for the C64, for the C128, for the VIC-20, plus four. I don't know what the plus four EMU is. Maybe that's actually just a different version, a different Pi version in a PET. But so the idea is that essentially you can, it is running emulation, but it's running it, it's giving, you know, full access to the Pi hardware. And it's kind of a neat project. So I was hoping I could try this, but I mean, yeah, I didn't. that's the amount of time I had was just for the hoping and not for the actual doing. So I'm kind of interested to try this, but Earl, have you come across this before, being the Commodore person?
I've seen it before. I haven't tried it before. I'll say one of the benefits of bare metal emulation like this is that the timing is absolutely deterministic, mm-hmm. as opposed to running on a modern OS where you've got 1,000 other things going on. On something like this, that's running bare metal, you can fix some of those more pesky timing issues or whatever, because you know if I'm running on a Raspberry Pi 3, for instance, that I'm going to have the exact timing of a Raspberry Pi 3 and nothing else is competing with me.
Yeah.
Does it support, I see the one emulator mode needs the Pi 3, but will it run on most Raspberry Pis? I think there's actually a zero.
You know, like a version for almost everyone, every Pi that you can get. That's what I seem to remember. It's been a while since I've actually looked carefully at this, but for some reason they split this up. So I guess basically you can get sort of pre-configured individual versions of Vice, you know, for each of the models that you want to emulate. On the BMC 128 page, there are a number of screenshots of what it looks like and so forth. And the 128 can sort of switch between modes and behave in a 128 way. It does look like it might be just models 2 and 3. Not quite sure.
Well, yeah.
It's for the Raspberry Pi
8 anyway.
But I don't know. I'm not sure if everybody's in the same situation, but I'm kind of like, the Raspberry Pis are sort of like tribbles.
Yeah, you get one.
I have many of
suddenly
them just
you've got
all
10.
Over the place.
Yep.
I think I particularly want to figure out something to do with the two Bs, because I mean, like, I sort of feel like, you know, the underpowered ones, you know, I'm not going to want to run a media center on them or whatever now that I have the ability to use the faster ones, but or the zeros too. Things that a zero or a 2B can do. I'm up for those suggestions. Anyway, check that out if you haven't. It's pretty easy to get set up, I think. I think that's it for the news. And I guess we can leave it there and say, and now, a word from our sponsor.
An Apple IIc, or the higher intelligence of the new Commodore 128. The Commodore 128 is expandable to 512K memory by adding this. To do the same with an Apple, you'd have to buy three more. The 128 has a built-in keypad. You'd have to buy a separate one. Graphics? The new Commodore 128 can paint rings around the Apple IIc. You'd have to add color sprites and 30 block graphics sets to come close. For two joysticks, you'd have to add another port. To match the sound, an Apple would have to add two more voices and four instruments. Plus, the Commodore 128 runs its own advanced programs, along with over 3,000 Commodore 64 programs. To do that with a 2C, you'd have to add a Commodore 64. Commodore 128 personal computer, a higher intelligence at a lower price.
And we're back. Okay, so the host retro computing gift idea this time was provided by Jack, I think, actually, but we'll take it and use it anyway. This is it's a Redbubble store that's largely Atari-themed. It's Steve Boswell's store. But what Jack had specifically pointed out was the existence of many different mask designs you can get. So you can, if you want to get a fitted three-layer mask that has an Amiga logo on it, in fitting the theme of the show, there's one here. Or just the regular, like, Fuji Atari logo. An Asteroids one. There's a Boeing demo ball one, and there's a Spectrum one as well. So there's many different designs. They're not all Amiga, though most of them seem to be. Here's a Acorn one. Anyway, it's kind of cool.
You can wear your mask and you can be retro styling.
May as well, if you're gonna be wearing one anyway, may as well.
Might as well be retro.
Be a nerd.
Totally agree.
Oh, there's a ready one. I kind of like the one that says ready cursor. That's kind of nice. Is that Atari or is that Commodore?
No, it's Commodore. You see what happens when you're not here, Carrington?
That's right. It just turns into
turn the whole show into Commodore a Commodore show.
Anyway, they're not expensive. They're $16 if you buy four or more.
That is cool.
That's kind of cool.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Okay, let's see. So now, when you are done buying your Atari/Spectrum/Acorn masks, you can turn your attention to eBay, where Blake has some suggestions. I don't think either of them are Amiga things.
So the first item I found, it's entitled Old Apple Macintosh Lot and IBM. And its current bid is $500. There's no buy it now. It's 3 days, 18 hours left. 15 bids, $200 shipping, which is pretty good given the size of some of the hardware here. But the thing about this is, you see, there it looks like I see a couple of, you know, Quadra Max stacked. I see some TRS-80 Model 4 P's. It looks like some Mac 2SI, random PC Tower, Macintosh Plus. But another device, another item here that also seems like it's seen things is a Lisa 2, which is really sweetens the pot for this collection of computers. The Lisa 2, I mean, this one looks like it's been buried in mud, but it could be a, you know, a 2 with a hard drive, a 2.5, 2.10. It's hard to say. Not mentioned, or at least not mentioned in any big way. Yeah, the description is old Macintosh and IBM lot. Selling as is, they are all untested. You know, $500 for an untested Lisa 2 might not be a bad price.
No, I mean, like you have to find a place to put all this other stuff, but
might be worth it. So yeah, it was the Lisa that stood out. Kind of jumps at you if you see it. But it looks a barn find would be understating the situation with this Lisa 2. I'm afraid I can't imagine where it actually was stored. The Mac Plus on top looks pretty clean. Some nice CRTs, the DS2 CRTs. But anyway, it's just I think notable because of the Lisa. But it may not work. Again, I mentioned shipping $200, which that actually seems pretty good, doesn't it?
I wonder if that seller is going to wind up regretting that when the shipping is more than the ultimate payment ended up being.
Mm-hmm. Right. I have a specific memory of taking like PowerMac 6100, the small pizza box with a monitor and everything. And I think like 15 years ago, it cost me $90 to ship it or something. I don't know. It seems like this is going to be hundreds and hundreds of dollars, more than $200. But anyway, so that Lisa may or may not work. And then I only had one other item. I believe we talked about a related item to this a few podcasts ago. I trust that we didn't actually talk about this specific item. I'm pretty sure we didn't. But I believe this is the same individual. There's an engineer or a person of note in Texas Instruments Engineering Department back when who passed away. Do you think this is the same person, Paul? Do you remember the conversation about
it? I remember talking about it. I don't know. Let's see. Well, so I'm not sure if the seller's the same, but this, unless there was just a sudden decimation of the ranks of TI engineers.
It doesn't have to be the same individual, but I think it probably is. But they, in the estate, is a rare Texas Instruments unknown hex bus PCM prototype card. It says Program Director C.B. Wilson, another rare vintage piece of computing history. Single PCM for unknown peripheral with hex bus interface. Yeah, so that, you know, TI was on the verge of launching the TI-99-8 and this new bus system that was going to allow all these external data storage devices, I/O devices, printers. Anyway, it was all going to happen, and then TI backed out of the game. And this is another prototype that was going to use that forward-thinking protocol, which actually ended up getting used electrically the same. The bus is used in some TI calculators further down the line, but that was kind of just not really the same angle that we thought it was headed, sadly. But so there's some photographs of the board. I can't I can't make out a lot of much sense of, you know, what we're seeing here. I don't know what it's probably. It looks like a that chip doesn't ring a bell to me. But anyway, so this is a, if you collect TI items and you're a Hexbus collector, this is probably a pretty interesting item. It's current bid $22.50, 7 watchers, 2 bids, 2 days, 2 hours left, and $6 shipping from Dallas, Texas. So that is the totality of what I have this time around.
All right. Earl, you have the next thing.
I do. I have an S100 computer. And I have a personal connection with this one that will probably resonate with at least 2 other people in the entire world. So, so putting this one up was, you know, kind of nostalgia reasons for me. But the interesting thing about it, it's an S100 from California Computer Systems. And if I'm looking at the photos right, it appears to work. It's a Z80 based system. Looks like it has 64K of RAM. And when they plugged it in and turned it on and hooked it up to a terminal, you can lightly see there, it's not a good picture, but it looks like CPM is actually booted up on the system.
Mm-hmm.
So now, what's the story? Other than the fact that I think it's kind of rare to find a functional S100 system on eBay. A lot of the times you'll just find the cards or maybe a chassis or whatever, and it's not quite working, but this one appears to be working. But the second thing is, the store I used to work at back in the 80s sold these. And not only that, but the owner of the store chain that I worked at had a connection, either was part of or was connected to people who were part of California Computer Systems, which is one of the reasons why this was the only S100 system that we sold. So I remember these, and it's interesting. Some of the reading that I did said that the CCS systems were pretty reliable compared with the universe of S100 systems that were out there at the time. And I used it briefly while I was there. I never tried to sell one because I was focused on the 8-bit home computers like the Atari and the Commodore. I didn't really get into these systems, and I kind of kick myself now thinking I had these at my disposal in spare time. I could have learned about them, but I didn't. But I definitely remember these, so that's why I picked it. The price, I don't know about the price. You'd have to, what is it?
It's
$1,200, but it does have a make offer, which is interesting. I always like the buy it nows that have a make offer option. You know, I think they're more likely to sell them. Mm-hmm. So is it worth $1,200? I don't know. It's kind of hard to say. If you had a particular nostalgia for a CCS system, then again, you're one of those handful of people that are out there that actually used these in the past. And it didn't look like it was in bad shape. Didn't look all beaten up.
Yeah. It's interesting. There's really there's not much of anything like an overview photo that I can see. So I feel like I don't have a very good concept of what this looks like. There are a couple different pieces. There's a dual disk drive piece, and then there's like a computer piece that I guess has the, you know, the motherboard and the CPU boards and stuff in it.
They're big.
But, yeah. It's in a sense, we have a lot of nice detailed pictures, but I can't assemble them in my head very well.
But no general system photo. Yeah. That's a good point.
Does it come with the monitor?
No, the terminal doesn't come with it. I see. Say that it is. It appears to be on another auction, though.
I see. Okay. Cool.
That's it for me?
I knew California Computer Systems as a company, but I did not know that they made an S100 machine. I guess I knew that they made S100 cards, though. So it makes some sense.
I feel like I recognize their snappy logo, the kind of
Definitely
intertwined CCS from some old Creative Computing magazines, surely.
Yeah, they definitely made a bunch of like Apple II cards. So memory cards and coprocessor cards and things like that. So, cool. Okay, let's see. I guess I have mine. So the first one is, it's a Y cable for an Apple IIe card. And this is not... So I think we've talked about, you know, many, many times we have talked about the Apple IIe card, which is basically an Apple IIe on a card that goes into a certain set of early Macintoshes. So it sits in a processor direct slot. There's a few, but the sort of most famous ones that can run these are the LC types, the pizza box shaped types. But the thing about them is the card lives inside the computer, and then there's this adapter cable which connects to a disk drive and a joystick, or like a, you know, game controller device. And the schools were largely the people who bought these things, and they did not take great care to keep the cables with the machines when they dumped them in the dumpsters or sold them at the auctions or whatever. So there are a lot of 2E cards out there there are a lot of 2E cards that just got thrown in the trash, sadly, but there are also a lot of 2E cards that do not have their cable. And to find a real original Apple cable is they're expensive and they're difficult to get. So what we are looking at here is somebody made a cable. Basically, it has the correct connectors on it. It looks homemade, but it works. It's being sold for the non-trivial amount of $85, but I'm sure it was not trivial to put together either. The seller basically says, you know how hard these are to find. If you're looking at this auction, I just got tired of looking for them and so decided to make some. Anyway, so if you are looking for one, rather than searching for a needle in a haystack, you can just buy a fabricated one. You presumably could make your own like this person did. The question is, would you spend more than $85 worth of your time? I guess if you get something out of doing it. So it's expensive for a cable, perhaps, but I think it's cheaper than the alternative of like finding an original Apple one. What is the next one? Oh, it's a Super Pet. I thought Earl might find this interesting.
I've only seen one once.
Yeah.
In person.
And this, so it's a Super Pet 9000. And it's it looks like a pet. Actually, it has the bezel looks a little different from what I thought pet bezels looked like, but it seems to work. And I forget what's special about these is that they have a 6809 in them as well, right?
Yeah, they're dual CPUs, and they also had a series of software that went along with them for support of various programming languages. Now, if you use this without a disk drive and without that software, I'm not sure what the advantage would be for you in terms of having a super pet versus one of the regular pets.
Mm-hmm. Did the 6809, was there a different operating system, or I'm curious?
Yeah, there was different software that took advantage of the 6809 and supported those languages from Waterloo that they put out for this.
Okay. It's not as if it was running software from, like, adding a Z80 to something in order to run CPM on it, a pre-existing thing from another platform. This was still specific mm-hmm. to the pet, but just 6809 based.
Yeah. Yeah, it was all custom.
Mm-hmm.
Huh.
Curtis asks in the chat whether there was an OS9 port to the Super Pet, thinking that perhaps there was.
I don't know that answer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It seems like the kind of thing a retro computing enthusiast might do. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't put it past a retro computing enthusiast to do that. But
right.
Anyway, yeah, I think and Matt says yes there was, so makes sense. But anyway, yeah, I think it's neat to see. This auction has been up for a while. I mean, like, I had put this in our show notes when we thought we were going to record, like a month ago or whatever it was, and it's still there. So it's $1,200. It's shipping from Nova Scotia, I think, right? This is the $125 US shipping down to me.
Earl, was this the ultimate Commodore pet, Earl?
Kind of, although it was put together for sort of a limited purpose. It was put together for a university environment, for an education environment where you'd be learning various programming languages.
Okay.
I don't know.
So not so much.
I mean, it's one of the more unobtainium kind of pets. Mm-hmm. So the price there doesn't shake me. But in terms of if you just want a general purpose pet to do Commodore pet things that people did, then this wouldn't necessarily be the ultimate for you.
Gotcha.
Cool. Let's see, the next thing, I thought this was interesting. This is it's a kit for making, it's intended, I guess, for making an Apple II circuit board, but sort of back in the days before there were, you know, CAD programs to do layouts for you or whatever. So it's actually got like a bunch of stickers to place on a template board. Somewhere there's a picture of the template board. I'm not sure if you're actually like, you know, using Acid to put down traces on this or whether you're sending this off to somebody to make the board for you once you put the stickers down, or I don't know exactly how this works, but it's just kind of interesting to see the kind of like old tech for doing something like this.
Oh, that's fascinating. So that's kind of a take on etch resist, the old fashioned way to make PCBs, but instead of drawing it with an etch resist pen or something like that, you're doing it with stickers.
Yeah, and I don't know if, I mean, it might be that what this really is an art project, you know, like you draw out your circuit and then somebody else will etch it for you or something. Like, I'm not sure if these stickers are able to resist acid or absorb acid or whatever it is that the etching process requires. It's interesting. It's an interesting thing, at least. I'd be kind of curious to get it and read the instructions, although they might be in German.
Yeah, see, it's manufactured in California, but the pre-cut stick-on with the K kind of raised an eyebrow as far as whether that, you know, that's actually made in California. I don't know why my gut feeling with this is the extreme unlikelihood that the end result would work. I don't know. It seems like I picture myself, okay, I'm, you know, here we go. We've created the board. These stick-ons are here. Now let's see. But yeah, I guess we don't know if they're right, if you're like using the acid wash to trace. I'd never heard of anything like this before.
So Al in the chat says etch resist stickers is the
okay.
So perhaps they are actually active.
Yeah, I guess so. And you know, well aware of the hand drawing and that method, I just had never seen anything like, you know.
And it's going for nothing. I mean, like, you know, it has no bids. It has basically a week left. It starts at $10. So if you are interested, it can be yours.
You could really decorate the back of your MacBook Pro with. You could go crazy with those circuit stickers on the back.
Yeah, once you've designed your card and have all the stickers left.
Yeah, when you've got whatever you have left over, sure.
Yeah, from what I'm reading in the chat, it seems like, in fact, the active part is probably the card that you put it on. So these are these are blocking light, basically. So they're not very active stickers, but they are effective in blocking the light that would affect the rest of the surface.
Card. Yeah.
So.
Interesting. Very interesting.
Cool. Okay, let's see. Since this came up, I'll just say it. The next auction is a flip and file, so it's a 5 1/4 inch floppy holder. I don't know how popular these were. This for me specifically has a giant burst of nostalgia because I had one of these, you know, when the Apple II was new, and not only that, but I kept this box. Like this box, even long after. I mean, I think I still have the plastic box as well, but the cardboard box that holds it, which comes in this auction, you know, that was sort of bought in the box. It was a box that was sold in a box. But I used the cardboard box that contained the plastic box as a disc holder also. So, in fact, I might even still have it. You know, it's still like it like, except that this is a nicer shape than mine is. The other thing about this is that it's one of these sort of top lifting disc boxes, and it's somebody has put an Apple computer sticker on the front of it, exactly where mine was.
I think everyone did that.
Yes, that was exactly the point I wanted to make. Blake is holding up his, showing exactly the same thing.
Apple sticker on the front. I think you were required to do that. Definitely. Indeed.
Anyway, I thought that was fairly hilarious, and I think it is even more hilarious that Blix also has that
within arm's reach.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. Let's see. And I think the last one I'll mention is just I'm not sure that this is interesting. I don't know if it is interesting, but it's Broderbund, the arcade machine title, and the auction itself is not anything in particular, I think. You know, it's something that Broderbund sold. It's actually one of the first bits of, you know, actual software that I bought myself. And in a sense, it's kind of, you know, I think I had, when I bought it, I think I had in mind the kind of sort of whatever Desert Island Discs game, you know, or something like, it's sort of like, if I'm going to buy a piece of software, the piece of software I'm going to buy is one that helps me make other pieces of software. So this is it's basically like an arcade game construction kit. And it's pretty cool. I mean, it basically makes the things it's specialized for are kind of like top-down Space Invaders, you know, type games, or Galaga or something, you know, Galaxian type things, where you make the shapes and they come down at you and you shoot at them, and you can design the backgrounds and the individual players, and there's certain parameters that you can set, but that's essentially what it's doing. And they all, you know, they're basically using, I don't know, there's some sort of like backing tool set that Broderbund used in other games. And so, you know, what you make is something that looks kind of like a Broderbund game. So it makes you feel like you've done something cool.
So you could actually make something that didn't look decidedly necessarily novice. Like if you really put some time into it, like it actually, you might be fooled into thinking that it was, you know, a game sold in a Ziploc bag or something sometime.
Yep, exactly, yeah. And, I mean, like, you know, if you spent some time with the graphics, they weren't bad. I'm trying to remember if this was a requirement or not, but I think when you saved them out, it saved them out as copy protected, too, which is totally irritating, because, you know, I made a couple of these, and, you know, I'm not sure if I have copies of them anymore, because, you know, they're not easy to back up. But
I guess they didn't want you competing with the Broderbund themselves. I don't know.
I mean, I think you were allowed to sell games with this. I mean, like you could make them and sell them. And in fact, actually, there's what is it called? K-Tech, I think. And there's a couple of others. These like little shovelware type software companies where I'm sure we talked about this before. Someone had dug up the fact that this is actually something a bit like a tax scam, where, you know, there were a bunch of investors that were investing in the creation of software titles, and they would make really kind of like nice boxes and things like that. But then all these games were just garbage that were, you know, put together in a night or whatever. And there's a bunch of them that are actually arcade machine titles. You know, it's clearly things that were made with this software.
Interesting. Wow.
And, you know, those are okay, but I mean, they're junk arcade machine titles. I mean, anyway, I thought it was kind of interesting, just the existence of the thing.
So you haven't run across, you know, like an archive somewhere of, you know, thousands of arcade machine deprotected games or anything that people have made. That would be interesting to find.
I haven't looked. I mean, like, I think, you know, there probably are. I mean, I kind of wonder about that with, like, Load Runner levels and Pinball Construction Set levels and things like that. Like, there must be a ton of those.
Yeah, I remember getting discs, like, that were copied around at school, and they were, like, full of this one guy's PCS, you know, maps, and they were good, you know, and everyone would, you know, trade this or that game for that. Yeah, interesting.
Yeah. Anyway, I will leave it at that. Those are my auctions. I think we have nobody left. I still, you know, looking at the show notes, I've talked about like a quarter of the auctions that I've written down. But whatever, there'll be other shows. It's been, what is the little thing in the corner says? We've been on YouTube for 2 hours and 27 minutes, which is absurd. So I think maybe we can move to closing discussions.
So, sounds good.
Blake, do you have any closing thoughts about Amiga video?
Well, let's see. Amiga. I wanted to mention one thing. I guess it's been a retro-heavy time since the last recording. One of the things I've done, which I'm showing a picture of now for the YouTube video, is I installed a Ultimate 1 Meg memory expansion in my PAL Atari 800XL. And it allows, the 800XL has 64K RAM, but there's a lot of demo scene productions that were made in recent years that need, you know, certainly 128, but more 256, 320K. I think retail is like $75. I ended up paying closer to 100. I got it already equipped with a particular attractive ROM set that you really want for it, called Jazzy Cat ROM. But anyway, it was just a few, since my Atari was entirely socketed, I was just able to get it in there with just a few solder points, I think four solder points. And it's been great. It's like, I'm seeing things from the A8 that I had, you know, it's shocking. It feel like I'm, you know, sitting in front of an Amiga watching some of these demos. So that's cool. And I've been doing a few other things, but I'm going to do a blog post on a couple of those, and maybe we can talk about those later. But yeah, it's, for whatever reason, it's been a really retro few weeks, and that's always a good thing. So yep, that's me. How about you guys?
That's cool. Earl, it seems like you made it to the 2.5 hour mark without losing power.
I didn't power down. I think with me, cleanup and reorg has been my thing, and I made some strides since the last time we recorded, got some new shelving, did some reorganization of my storage. All of that really helped. And a lot less clutter. Now, that's been... And that will probably continue to be one of my main things over the next couple months, is just trying to get the retro space to the point where I can actually use it and enjoy it. That's my main thing right now.
Mm-hmm.
Cool.
Maybe I'll just quickly mention this in the chat's closing notes. There apparently is an archive for, what does it stand for? The shoot 'em up construction kit, which existed. I think it looks like it's basically targeting Commodore 64 and Amiga, but well, looks like there's some other Atari ST too, which is kind of an archive of the sort of thing that you were talking about, Blake. The, you know, like for this particular platform, games that people had made.
Right, kind of analog. That's the more when you think about that's kind of an interesting little glimpse into a bunch of, you know, quote games that you probably wouldn't run across unless you went searching for them. So I'll definitely check out the shoot 'em up construction kit. But also I'm going to probably see if I might see if there's anything around for the Bertabund item that you, that you were mentioning.
That would be interesting. I think in fact, you know, now it would be kind of fun to maybe spend some time making one, you know?
Yeah. Yes.
Like some sort of like a, you know, COVID shooting game or something. Something that would be like clearly made in the modern time.
The modern time. Yeah. That's, I mean, you definitely have to have, you know, masks as part of it.
That's right. It's like a part of the power up or something.
Right. You've gotten a triple layer mask with, with an acorn logo on the side.
Perfect.
Yeah. So that's, yeah.
As far as I'm concerned, let's see. So I have retro aspirations, but I have not had I've not had very much time at all recently. I think I've mentioned a couple of times, we're in the process of kind of moving, and so that's taken up a fair amount of time. I'm getting there, and I'm actually kind of looking forward to having a sort of intentionally set up space in a way that I have yet to have. It's funny, the place I'm moving out of is one that I originally moved into thinking, well, this is going to be a temporary place that I'll be in while I look for a permanent place. And it's been like 11 years. So anyway, so the plan is that the next place will be set up with intent.
Excellent. Hey, does this mean that some of your office stockpile will move to the... to the home?
Yeah, I think so. I think that's my intention. Actually, I'm going to move a lot of that stuff with me. I'm actually going to downsize pretty seriously too, I think. But I'm sure you'll hear about that as well. But that it's an excuse to go through stuff as well. But I'm going to try to make it down from having, like, you know, 12 Mac SEs to maybe one. Something like that.
There have been crazier notions.
Yeah. But okay, I think maybe it's good enough for now. So that's it for this show. You can find show notes for this and all the RCR shows at rcrpodcast.com. You can discuss the show in the forums at vcfed.org/forum/forum.php. You can follow RCR on Twitter at rcrpodcast. You can join our Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/rcrpodcast. You can send feedback to feedback@rcrpodcast.com. We are a member of the Throwback Network at throwbackreviews.com. You can write a review in iTunes if you want. And until next time, Retro Compute.